Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Katie Weaver, and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
When corals are mentioned, many people think of rock life forms in the sea filled with colorful fish. But corals are made up of hundreds of thousands of small organisms which live and feed like any other sea life. For the past 5 years, researchers in Hawaii and Australia have been engineering corals inside a lab to see if they could better resist the effects of climate change. They say it is now time to see how their creations perform in nature. The scientists say climate change linked to human causes has led to warming oceans that can harm sea life. They say if the more heat-resistant corals they developed do well in the ocean, the method can be used to help save suffering and dying reefs. The team tested 3 methods for making corals that would be strong and healthy in nature. One was the method of selective breeding. This method involves scientists choosing parents with desirable characteristics for reproductive purposes. The goal is to produce babies with the same desirable characteristics. A second method subjected the corals to increasing temperatures to condition them to be able to survive in warm ocean environments. The third involved making changes to the algae that provide corals with necessary nutrients. The leader of the project, University of Hawaii researcher Kira Hughes, said all the methods proved successful in the lab. She told the Associated Press that some scientists might worry that such methods go against the natural processes of nature. But with the planet continuing to warm more and more, she does not see any better options. "We have to intervene in order to make a change for coral reefs to survive into the future," Hughes said. "When ocean temperatures rise, corals release algae that supplies nutrients and gives them color. This causes them to turn white, a process called bleaching. When this happens, corals can quickly become sick and die." But for years, scientists have been observing corals that have survived bleaching even when others have died on the same reef. They are now centering on those healthy survivors and hoping to further increase their resistance to heat. Those corals were used as the parents for the newly created kinds. A recent study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and other research organizations took a close look at bleaching events. It found them to be the biggest current threat to the world's coral reefs. Scientists found that between 2009 and 2018, the world lost about 14% of its corals. Corals are threatened worldwide by a lot of stressors, but increasing temperatures are probably the most severe, said Crawford Drury. He is the chief scientist at Hawaii's Coral Resilience Lab. Madeline Van Open is a research scientist with the Australian Institute of Marine Science. She told the AP there were concerns about whether the experiments could result in a loss of genetic diversity. And there were critics who said the scientists were playing God by making such changes to the reef. Well, you know, humans have already intervened with the reef for very long periods of time, Van Open said. All we're trying to do is to repair the damage. Rather than editing genes or creating anything unnatural, the researchers are just attempting to begin what could already happen in the ocean, Van Open added. In this way, she said, the team can center on a small area to keep and enhance what is already there. I'm Brian Lynn.
There was so much to look forward to at the start of 2021. The question was when, and not if, the health crisis that spread from a market in Wuhan, China, would finally end. Scientists developed two highly effective vaccines against the coronavirus in record time. Several more were waiting for approval.
Governments in the United States, Europe, and Israel spent billions of dollars to start the biggest vaccination program in history. The effort included vaccines from drug companies Pfizer-BioNTech, Moderna, and others. China and Russia developed their own vaccines. And the UN-backed COVAX program purchased shots for developing and poor countries around the world. In May, the U.S. and Western nations expanded the program to vaccinate young children. Health officials issued new guidelines advising that fully vaccinated people no longer needed to wear face coverings in most situations. The move was seen as the first step toward returning to normal conditions that existed before the pandemic.
But scientists began to worry about the new versions of the coronavirus, called variants, soon after people started to receive the new vaccines. It is normal for viruses to mutate or change over time. A mutation that strengthens the virus helps it to spread by pushing out the weaker versions. In February, the head of Britain's vaccination effort said the world faced around 4,000 variants of the virus that causes COVID-19. But only some would raise concern. There were so many variants of concern with hard-to-remember scientific names that the World Health Organization started to name them after the letters of the Greek alphabet. The two most worrisome variants now are Delta and Omicron. In the early days of the pandemic, many Asian countries appeared to have successfully fought the virus with strong measures. By July, countries including Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, and Thailand were setting records for new cases and deaths. The Delta variant appeared at a difficult time. When it started being reported, vaccination rates remained low in many countries, and officials were moving quickly to reopen economies. Then, infections of the Delta variant became widespread. Governments, businesses, and schools reacted with more vaccination requirements and restrictions. Some countries started to restrict international travelers and close borders over concerns about the fast-spreading Omicron variant. The U.S., Israel, Britain, and other nations now advised their citizens to get an additional shot, called a booster, to fight the new variant.
After another year of face coverings, restrictions, vaccines, and variants, people are beginning to wonder whether this pandemic will ever go away. The answer is yes and no. Many scientists believe that the new coronavirus is here to stay. In February, the science publication Nature reported the results of a study involving more than 100 scientists. 89% said they believed the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that causes COVID-19 disease, will become endemic. Endemic means the virus will continue to exist in some areas for years to come. For example, malaria is considered endemic to many warm, wet areas across countries in Asia, Africa, and South America. But it is not a problem in the United States or other Western nations. The way to end a pandemic is to reach herd immunity. Herd immunity is when many people in a community either have recovered from an infection or have been vaccinated. It does not mean everyone is protected from the virus. However, when herd immunity is reached, the virus can no longer spread easily, which helps protect those who are at risk. As nations joined together to fight the pandemic, health officials started to sound the alarm about another public health crisis: mental health. The U.S. Surgeon General said the pandemic's high number of deaths, forced social distancing, and lockdowns of the economies have created new pressure, especially on young people. He wrote, "It would be a tragedy if we beat back one public health crisis only to allow another to grow in its place."
There is hope, however. In early November, American drug maker Pfizer reported that its experimental antiviral pill for COVID-19 cuts hospitalizations and death rates by nearly 90% in high-risk adults. This came after Merck had reported success in testing its version of the COVID-19 pill a month earlier. Although health officials have already approved several treatments for COVID-19, all of them must be injected by healthcare workers. But pills can be taken at home and are easier to send around the world. Both companies have since agreed to provide other drug makers with special permission to produce the COVID pills. The move is aimed at helping people in poorer countries get the drug. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge Sugar Trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the Sugar Trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. but the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.